You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Do you like what you're hearing right now? Then be sure to check out VOC Nation. Whether it's on VOCNation.com or your favorite podcast provider, VOC Nation offers the greatest in live and on-demand content, great interviews, and incredible insight from those who have lived the business. 7 days a week, VOCNation.com. And don't forget to check us out on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Welcome to another edition of Bumps and Thumps, the Talk of Wrestling. I'm Brian Ferguson. I have two guests today. One, frequent flyer. Man that, you know, needs no introduction, Mr. George Shire. Come on in, George.
How you doing, buddy? Good morning.
I'm doing great.
I keep thinking it's Saturday, but it's Friday.
And we got another guy.
It's tough when you got two of them in the same week.
Yeah, and we got one more guest. Let's introduce this young man here.
Hey, this is exciting. It's always fun for me when we have book authors and new books on wrestling and wrestlers specifically. I love wrestler books. And we've got a good one today. We got a guy by the name of John Finkel. And do you bring him in? You've got him.
He's
up
in.
Here.
He's
John,
in.
John, we want to welcome you.
Thank you.
You have come out with a great book. I've been looking through it. I got to admit, I haven't read the whole book. But what I see is I like it. And I'm going to hopefully, along with you, urge people to run out, grab this baby when it comes out. I guess, John, you've written a lot of books as we did a little bit of research. And I also saw you, and I want to clarify right away. The first question I had when I saw your name, I thought, is this guy related to Howard Finkel? Well, you answered the question, no, you're not. John Finkel. And you got some pretty impressive friends, Tony Dungy, you know, some of those guys. So Tell us a little bit about John Finkel.
Yeah. So number one, you mentioned the Howard Finkel line. That was when I was starting to write the book and research the book. I interviewed Randy's brother, Lanny Poffo, who was very difficult to get a hold of. He lived in Ecuador. It took well over a year to get a hold of him and finally get him, you know, available to be on board for interviews. And that was the first question he asked me was, are you related to Howard Finkel? And I said, no, I'm not. I said, but my dad's name is Harvey Finkel. So, you know, the same initials, maybe we can use that. And he was a man, if you knew him at all, loved coincidences and linguistic, sure, you know, play, wordplay like that. So that was a nice way to break in and talk to him. And then we spoke for hours and hours after that.
What was his reaction when you told him that you want to do a book on his brother?
Well, it was on the heels of a couple of those documentaries that he, along with most people, did not think did a really good job as far as expressing the full Randy Savage experience. And so, sure, you know, he was a little leery having not met me and, you know, thinking they were some kind of, you know, those had clearly angles they were coming into before they even filmed and trying to get salacious content up and things like that. So I had to really lean on, which is a nice segue, into sort of the other books that I'd written to show him, A, I'm not just a wrestling guy, not that there's just, but I'm not a genre guy where I'm just plowing through different wrestling characters and reading biographies. In fact, I've done biographies with Mean Joe Green and Charlie Ward and NBA players. And I did a book on the Seattle Supersonics. So I'm very much more of a mainstream sports writer. However, in terms of my background, I spent the early part of my career writing for Muscle and Fitness and Men's Fitness and GQ. And basically, if it had men's or health or fitness in the title, I wrote for it back in my 20s. And one of the best parts of that was when I was doing cover stories, I did do a lot of NFL and NBA players, but when I got to Muscle and Fitness, I got to do a lot of WWE guys. I did cover stories with Triple H and with Batista and with Brock Lesnar, a bunch of the Divas. We did things for Muscle and Fitness, hers. Then UFC guys too, Frank Mir and Randy Couture, which all kind of mingle around in that world. And so that was really my first taste of, you know, in the journalism side, getting into the WWE. I had already written several books by the time I was doing that, but I had had this idea of writing a Macho Man book for a long, long time, basically since I started writing books. And he fits this mold of the kind of people and characters that I like, which are one of ones, like totally unique, inciting individuals. Like I mentioned, Charlie Ward, you know, or those aren't familiar, you know, wins a Heisman Trophy, wins a national championship at Florida State, and then finds himself playing point guard for the Knicks in the NBA Finals. Like, I'm pretty sure we're not going to see that again. You know, Mean Joe Green, small school, you know, makes, you know, comes out of nowhere out of North Texas, goes to a horrible Steelers team that can't win a game. And then, you know, four Super Bowls later, an all decade player, one of the maybe most three or four most famous defensive players in the history of the NFL. You know, so I look for people who have a unique story that aren't just sort of like A to B to success. Things were pretty easy and they were always kind of on top. And Macho Man completely fit that bill. And I was all pleased and excited and kind of like, it was happy to me that no one had done a book for him, right? Like, I was stunned that no one had tackled him before, but I was very happy because it allowed me to do so.
So were you a wrestling fan? I mean, you talked about all these things and how you kind of got around and you mentioned Triple H and stuff. Had you followed Macho Man then or become a fan of wrestling?
Yeah, that's all. Everything I just mentioned was on the professional side. On the fandom side, I have been a Macho Man wrestling fan as far back as you can possibly remember. You'll appreciate this, George. I used to call myself Little John Studd after Big John Studd when I was like 6 years old. I was a huge, huge wrestling fan from like the time I was able to like walk. In fact, I went to my dad at one of his store signings growing up. I got to meet Big John Studd and have lunch with him. And, you know, once you meet one of these guys, especially when I was like seven, I think, you are all in. Yeah, I mean, his hand covered my head and like had like a 10-egg omelet and a loaf of French toast. And like, you know, when you see up close these humans who are
well,
like,
you got to do it big.
Yeah, yeah, it was amazing. And so after that, I mean, my parents, you know, I was young, but they told me I went from like being a fan to like my whole everything was Macho Man and was WWF. I had the lunch boxes and I had all the action figures. My brother and I, you know, the best part of it all, I have a younger brother who I was very close to. We used to just beat the crap out of each other. We tried every move. I'm sure both of you guys did with any siblings or friends you had. I mean, my mom to this day is like, I'd be downstairs and I'd hear just thud. And she'd be like, what are you doing? I'd be like, just a clothesline. You know, I'm just trying to leg drop off the bed, like just endless stuff. So I was all in from as early as you can be all in when it comes to wrestling.
That's awesome. And you know, I really, you did pick a character. That's for sure. So give us a little bit of the background about, okay, you liked Randy Savage and this, and I do want to tell you, when you talk about a wrestler, there have been so many of them, John, that have come down the pike over the past, let's say 20, 25 years, a wrestler book. And it's interesting what fans want. You do a book, and my idea is I want to know this wrestler. I want to get to know them better. I want to know what made them tick. I want to know how their career, how it started, where they got their ideas. And a lot of people, they say, well, do a book on so-and-so. Why isn't there a book? And many times there's books out there, people just don't know about it. So you picked Randy Savage, and obviously he had passed away by the time you did this, right?
Oh, 10 years. Yeah. He'd been gone 10 years.
10 whole years. Yeah. So yeah, you're stuck with, and of course, Angelo's gone, Randy's dad, and you're stuck with Lonnie. And that's not a bad thing because Lonnie was a cool dude.
Yeah. Lanny was like the torchbearer for the family. But really for 70s and, you know, wrestling, I mean, the man he'd been from his dad through him, you could be an encyclopedia of not only the territories, but really the rise of wrestling nationally from you know, their ICW outlaw, you know, rig to like, to getting, you know, Randy, the WWE, to him getting in the, I mean, he did have a month with Hogan. Like, he was in it. It wasn't like he was just, I mean, he never reached nearly the level of stardom of Macho Man. He always says, you know, other than the month Hogan gave me, I was sort of a jobber, you know, gimmicky guy. But he was there. He was in the company for a very long time. He's beloved by almost everyone who knew him backstage. He was charming. He was smart. And he really like the legacy to his family and his brother really mattered. And like you said, I mean, when I started writing the book in sort of a sad way, it was like the only living Poffo was Lanny. Macho was dead, and Liz was dead, and Angelo and Judy were dead. So, and Macho didn't have any kids. And so I had luckily, like I mentioned earlier, been able to have conversations with Lanny and really clarify a lot of the things that probably only he could have clarified. And then when he sadly passed away, as I mentioned in the intro to the book, like it was a little bit of a weight kind of came down on me as I'm writing this. Like, well, now they're actually, not that I was going to get anything wrong, but at least Lanny was still the face. Okay. And I'm not saying that I would be, but the book probably will be now. It was, I'm almost positive I did the last extensive interviews with Lanny on anything, especially his life and Randy and everybody. So it really is in some ways the most up to date. I mean, we've been messaging maybe weeks before he had passed. And so it became like, this is now the final, you know, say and countdown of what Lanny wanted to say about his brother and his family. So I dedicated the book to him. I'm not pretending at all for anyone listening. We weren't like good friends. I met him in the last 6 months of his life, but he was gracious and kind and answered all the questions I had and really helped inform the early part of the book.
Well, you know, and the way you say he's the last one, I always look at life as a puzzle, and people come into our lives and things happen for reasons and pieces come together. I think it's an omen that you had that opportunity to hook up with Lanny, the last piece of the Poffo puzzle, so to speak, and then get the information that you could from him, because like you say, now it's gone.
Yeah.
So in the book, and I don't know if you remember this, I do, and you cover it in the book, I'm believing, and as I told you, I haven't read the whole book yet, but I remember Lanny and Randy wrestling each other.
Yeah.
Back in before the WWF days. I want to say E sometimes, but WWF. And I always thought that was intriguing. That's the way wrestling was back in that territorial.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So, you know, it's very hard for any wrestling fan who's maybe become a wrestling fan, even in the last 20 years, or even in the age of social media or just cable, really, to understand that it was a local deal of live event, going to fairgrounds, going to armories, going to high schools for a very, very long time. And, you know, they could sell out major places. I mean, Gorgeous George sold out Madison Square Garden in the 50s, right? So it wasn't like this. It wasn't super niche. Some people did bubble to the top, but probably 95% of wrestlers made their living just bouncing around from, you know, Iowa to Michigan to Kentucky, the whole, you know, the Midwest, all the territories, the South. There was obviously things all over, you know, all over the coast and things, but they made their money just going on these loops, these 8, 10, 12-day loops, performing in Lexington and Paducah, and then going off to Chicago and DePlain. And they just did these crazy – it was a very, very hard, hard life. And so to what you had said earlier about them wrestling each other, they came up together. Now Randy, the to me, one of my favorite parts of the book and researching was his baseball career, right? I mean, Randy, for anyone listening who didn't know, was a legitimate, like – baseball player. He was the best baseball player ever to go to his high school. He was all state. He bat 500 his junior year, 500 his senior year as a switch hitter, hitting 500 both lefty and righty. He was like, by every coach I interviewed all his high school teammates, he was just a lock to be a major league baseball player. It's all he thought about. You know, you asked me about growing up, what I was a fan was, Randy was baseball. That was his number one thing. I mean, his dad wrestled and he was in wrestling, and he obviously went to his shows and worshiped his dad. But his room was filled with red stuff and Cardinals stuff and Cubs stuff and White Sox stuff. He wore, you know, baseball jerseys. He had a backpack and a baseball bat bag that he carried famously like all around his high school. I had so many people I interviewed from that era. He would sit in the back of class with a weighted baseball, like a 1 pound baseball, and do like triceps extensions and grip strength exercises just to get, you know, his strength down. They had a batting cage on the side of his house that Angelo built for him. Like, he was all baseball till the minute the dream died. And so the reason they started wrestling each other is because Lanny was establishing himself. Randy was trying to go from being 185-pound, you know, baseball player to a 240-pound wrestler. And when Angelo realized that he had these two thoroughbreds in his own backyard, you know, it was literally his own offspring, let's start our own promotion. We're kind of getting short shrifted on booking and money.
Sure.
They realized they could get a lot more out of all of their events if they didn't think it was like the Poffo family traveling, if it was Leap and Lanny Poffo versus this other person. And, you know, Randy, they didn't look, you know, Lanny was clean shaven. He had long, dark hair. Randy with the blonde hair in the beginning with the beard and the wild stuff. So Lanny was a little bit taller, obviously, like bulkier. So it was, I mean, I didn't know. I was, you know, I didn't follow them then. But even in the old genius Randy, you know, Macho Man phase, I didn't know they were brothers. And when they were just going town to town, you know, nobody had any idea. They couldn't have been more different.
Right. And that was the beauty, you know, for some of our listeners that don't know about those territory days. That was the beauty of the kayfabe era, as they called it, where wrestling was real.
Yep.
And we didn't have that access to find out that these two guys were related or they were brothers or their brother-in-laws, whatever the case may be. And so Lonnie Poffo against Randy Savage, that was, it happened. And it was cool. And when you mentioned Angelo, I think what I wanted to do back up a little bit is you mentioned all the statistics with baseball and the numbers that you were tossing out. The one thing that we can tell fans is that those are real numbers. If you know anything about baseball and every sport, but baseball specifically, they're statistic and number crazy. But every baseball player, you can rattle off their numbers. And so Randy was the real deal.
Oh man, you look at his like box score. I found all of them. They're all, you know, they're all in the local papers before the internet, before, you know, social media. Like there was an AM, you know, paper, a PM paper.
Yeah,
they're all out there. And like when you look at his box scores, it's just, it's almost like boring. It's like 3 for 5, 4 for 5, 2 for 5, 2 for 4, 1 for 3, just through for seasons and seasons. Yeah. And you know, like the idea that he hit 520 his junior year and then spent the summer learning to hit as a lefty. And then didn't drop off any average and was actually a power hitter on the opposite side of the plate. I mean, it just sounds ridiculous to say. Like, kids don't do that, right? He was that dedicated.
Yeah. Well, so you talk about that baseball career that could have been, probably should have been, and maybe what Randy wanted. So now enlighten us as to why it didn't happen.
Yeah, so he got everybody, all the coaches, the minor league coaches especially, they all kind of came to a point where, like, if there was a major league for hustle and heart, he would have been in it and probably an all-star. But at the end of the day, like where all minor league players' dreams die is getting to that upper level. And, you know, the five tool players, you know, are you a five-star, meaning five-star at all five tool players? You have a power arm. Can you throw? Can you hit for average, hit for power, all that stuff. And Randy was just like a 3 at all five tools. He wasn't exceptionally fast. He wasn't exceptionally strong. He could hit. There's a probably an alternate universe somewhere where he makes it as like a DH. But ultimately what did him in was he had a collision at home plate and he basically separated his right shoulder, hurt his collarbone. And this is actually probably the most amazing feat that he ever accomplished was he blew out his right arm. And that was when, you know, all his friends and teammates were like, hey, sorry, man, like it's over. Like you had a couple of years. And he went home and in typical like Randy Savage way, kind of lay in bed and thought, well.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
My right arm's gone, but I have two arms. I'm going to learn how to throw lefty. And this guy, the next day, I found a bunch of newspaper articles from that time, decided the next day to become a left-handed person, not a left-handed thrower. He brushed his teeth left-handed. He ate his breakfast left-handed, played poker left-handed, opened doors, combed his hair, just basically said shoved his right hand in his pocket. And just for months, he would go to, there was a Publix grocery store like a shopping center with a big brick wall in the back where the loading dock was. He would bring a bucket of 500 balls, and he'd throw 1,500 balls against the wall lefty every day, wow, day in and day out, the entire offseason to train his body to be able to throw basically a passable ball. He was a catcher, so a passable ball from home to third, home to second, I mean. And then ultimately he knew that probably wasn't going to work out, but if he could play first, he just needed to be able to get the ball out. And everybody was like, he did it. Like, he threw a ball lefty that was a passable 65, 70 mile an hour ball, but it was funky. You know, if you have a choice between someone who throws their natural arm or not, he wasn't that much of a power hitter to get over. And ultimately that plus just not having that thing, you know, he never just blew up. He made a couple all-star teams in the minor leagues, but he just never stood out for the call-ups. And then when he finally got the last cut slip, there was really nowhere else to go. There was nothing else he could improve on in baseball, and that was it.
You know, the interesting thing about when you say these things about Randy and having to work through that, we know that that takes an extreme amount of dedication and determination. And that makes me think back to that was in his genes, because some people may not know that his father, Angelo Poth, and I remember I was amazed at this feat back when I was a kid of 12 years old and I was seeing Angelo. And he was in the Guinness Book of World Records,
yes,
which that's a legit book. I don't know if it's still around today, but back then. And go ahead and tell Angelo's story, why he was in the book, because I remember when I heard it, I went down to the library and I had to see this.
Yeah,
my
friends
were telling me this is fake. And I'm telling them this dude, Angelo's a real guy.
Yeah, no, Angelo was in the Navy and he was, you know, he was a skinny guy and he found, you know, like most guys in their 18, 19 years old, he found the weight room and found out that his body really responded to weights and he got jacked up. And so he was competitive and kind of bored on base. There wasn't a whole lot to do. And he was looking for a record that he could break. And the Navy sit-up record, which happened to be the world record, was like 5,200 something. So the only caveat is that the man who had attempted it before him actually died of an aneurysm of all the effort. So the record had been sitting dormant for a little bit.
Yeah.
And he had made an attempt earlier. And the sit-ups back then, by the way, weren't just like your average, like go to the gym, see a guy doing crunches. This was nuts. You had to have your feet pinned down, you know, on the ground by somebody holding them. And you had to touch your elbow to each knee. So it wasn't just like pins, you know, up and down, up and down. It was a little bit more of a specific motion. And he had ruled a bunch of them as illegal. He didn't touch or go all the way, or, you know, you had to have your knuckles clasped behind your head. You had to touch the ground. So there was a counter there who would be like, and I can't imagine how annoying it'd be. Like, they would just repeat the numbers. So say he was at like 1,010, it would be like, until you got the next one, it'd be like 1,010, 1,010, 1,010, 1,011. Yeah. And you'd be like, oh my God, like those three didn't count. And when you're trying to get into the 5,000s, it's nuts. So Angelo, over 4 hours and 10 minutes, which is, just think about that, did 6,033 sit-ups. And the only thing that he ate during that time was that the trainer was like feeding him candy bars just to keep him going and giving him some water while he was going, because you weren't allowed to stop. And so, that is a – and
wow.
A book about, like,
were you aware of that record, Brian?
No. I remember it now that you said it, but I had forgot about it until you just mentioned it. I mean, that's just 6,033 sit-ups.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when he finished, he was like stuck. His hands were stuck behind his head because of the loss of blood flow, because they'd been clasped for, I mean, just hold your hands like this for 4 hours. Like, forget the push, like the sit-up part. Like, just do this for 4 hours and 10 minutes tight, like, because they had to be clasped. They couldn't undo his hands. He ended up, you know, needing to be carried to the hospital, and I'll let the book explain how it all shook out. But So to your point, you know, Macho had that grit in him throughout his life, and also just, it was not like anybody challenged Angelo. He just came up with it, and that was very much the Poffo way of, well, you know, no one's done this, so we'll just do this, instead of, you know, waiting for, to be, you know, asked permission, that kind of thing.
Well, and the thing to remember before we get off of Angelo, that record, that is something that it went with Angelo wherever he went, because when he traveled as a wrestler, that was a real deal. And I remember him being introduced, you know, at times, that the man who holds the sit-up record. And I like the way you described how you got to go from knee to knee. and yeah. you know, your feet are held down. When I, a million years ago, was in gym class and you were going to do sit-ups, that's the way we had to do it.
Yeah.
And I got news for you. If I got to 10, I was lucky.
Well, you know, what's funny is Angelo, for a long time, wrestled with the 6033 on his butt of his trunks. Like, yes, that was his calling yes. card.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's what I said. We know that Angelo was very determined. He was a very dedicated person. And obviously, Macho Man. He wasn't Macho Man yet, but boy, he got those genes. And when you can set a goal and achieve it, wow.
Yeah, it's impressive. The idea that he could decide to do the things he did, you know, like the decision to throw, you know, lefty is something. Then he, you know, baseball's over. And, you know, it wasn't like he was going to go become an accountant and sit in a cubicle somewhere. He was a born entertainer athlete.
He had the moves.
You know, and so then, you know, it's like, okay, obviously the family business was calling. Lanny had already had some modicum of success, meaning he'd become a wrestler already. He was on the road making some money. He was much bigger, like I said, you know, at this point in time, you know, Lanny was probably 6'2", 230, 240, and Macho was a skinny baseball player. So Macho, the transformation, the physical and mental transformation that he undertook from that point that baseball was over to the Macho Man that we all idolized, you know, later on, it's one of the more remarkable transformations in really in American entertainment. It's hard for people to understand it. And in the book, I try to do a good job of it, but all of his contemporaries were big people and no, like you'd see them in the mall or at school and be like, well, that guy stands out. Like Hogan walks into a room in high school. He's already 6'5", 240, yeah. 260. Like who's that guy? Andre the Giant, obviously. But even like Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Ted DiBiase right. and these other guys that were their contemporaries were big, bulky men. They were offensive linemen in high school. They were heavyweight wrestlers. They stood out. They were used to being the kind of big man on campus type person. That was not Macho. That was not Randy. You know, the man who was Randy Poffo was not that guy. He was athletic, but he was skinny and he was kind of like underwhelming as a physical presence. I mean, he was muscular if you saw him with his shirt off, but he could easily walk down the street and you would just say, oh, there's a lanky guy. So he went about transforming his entire physique so that then he could embody a character. So there wasn't that when he started getting bigger, there was no Macho Man or even Randy Savage. It was just, I need to get to a size where wrestling will accept me.
I wanted to ask you, John, you know, this transformation, what you're talking about, I'm sure it was quite demanding on Randy.
Yeah.
Was there like a competition, I guess I want to say, between him and his brother? As far as, I don't mean like meanness or I'm better than you, but like a pure, like, I'm going to get to the level you're, because Lanny, you said, was already pretty successful. I mean, he was ahead of the game a little bit of Randy. Was there that competition between those two? Like, I want to get to your level, brother, and if I can, beyond?
There definitely was competition from just a general dudes going after each other, brothers, competitive standpoint. Lanny, it seems, and even from talking to him and reading the clips all the way back in the newspapers in the 70s when people didn't know they were related. You know, remember, he's growing up in a house where his brother is the star. His older brother is the star of the town, right? Like he's used to, you know, it's not like all of a sudden overnight, oh my God, why does everybody know who my brother is? From the time he's 10, Randy is the most well sought after athlete in town. There's scouts at his games from the time he's a sophomore on. His brother's been in the newspaper already as a baseball player for years and years and years. He's all over the minor leagues. He knows, you know, Pete Rose. So when Randy finally goes into wrestling, he's already, you know, Lanny's looking up to his brother as like, he played professional baseball. Like he can do this. And then he even says from the first time he was in the ring, like they, you know, the proverbial like first run of when he was getting in, you know, barely putting on weight, 190 pounds. You could just tell he had it. And he said, he's like, I know it's hard. You're not going to, you know, I'm his brother. So, but I had already done a lot of other interviews and research. And even Dusty Rhodes, like he saw him at a Tampa Armory, like his third week of wrestling and was like, look, who's this small guy with all this talent, right? Like they kind of knew he had some kind of it because he was far more athletic. You know, even the guys back then, there was none of these crazy wrestling camps and wrestling academies. If you joined a program, you kind of just got mentored with here, go get hit, learn how to take the bumps, learn how to work. There wasn't this real business aspect to it. And Randy picked everything up by all accounts faster than everybody else. And when his body finally caught up, he was able to maintain his speed, being nimble. He did the high jumps off the rope. He was the first guy to jump off, you know, the ropes onto a table and smash a table. He was really a pioneer with all the twirling and the speed that he went off the ropes. And so the rivalry was a healthy rivalry. I don't think once they got going, Lanny ever had any belief that he was going to outshine his brother. Lanny was way better in their early promo years. And in fact, Macho was terrible at promos because he was a soft-spoken guy and always had been. And when they began to help, you know, Lanny helped him craft. I know it's a ridiculous thing to think about.
No, I'm just laughing because that's totally changed when...
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Dude, when I interviewed all his high school teammates and guys even who knew him in his neighborhood growing up and kids who play with him, they all refer to the Macho Man as the other guy. Like, people refer to, like, the Hulk and Bruce Banner. Like, it's the other guy. Because they didn't grow up with the Macho Man. They grew up with an amazing athlete, but he was quiet and, like, polite and clean-shaven and not, like, a rowdy, raucous guy at all. And so when Macho started breaking out, even in ICW, he was the draw. I mean... you always need a foil. You always need someone to be like the mid-card person. And Lanny was the other star in the promotion. But it was, I don't think he was ever under any illusions or at least any thoughts that like, I'm going to be 1A. I think it would have been, I mean, really, if you think about it, other than Hulk Hogan, there was no other one. Like every place he went, he was all eyes on him. So I think Lanny understood that he was, you know, brothers with a uniquely talented individual and was happy to kind of work with him and support him any way he could.
Yeah.
Was there ever, when you had talked with Lanny through the course of your book, was there ever any talk about would Macho Man or Lanny himself have been able to get in the business and get the recognition they did had their father not had that previous experience? Because Angelo was a heck of a star in the 50s and the 60s. And on top, most of the places he wrestled.
Yeah, it was all they knew. I don't think Lanny had any other aspirations. Well, earlier, Lanny also wanted to be a baseball player. He says, you know, he has a quote somewhere where he's like, I had the dream, Randy had the talent. Like, he wanted to be a baseball player, probably like I wanted to be a baseball player, right? Like, his dream died at like 13. And so it was a natural for him because the boys did travel a lot. In fact, when Randy and Lanny got a little older, Angelo would take them on loops with him around, you know, while he would perform, but he would schedule them around where there was some semi-pro baseball league. So people don't know that Randy actually made some like extra money catching for these semi-pro teams, some beer league teams. He'd make $5 a game catching because nobody had catchers. So he would just go and Angelo would wrestle at, you know, 7 p.m. at the, you know, whatever, like armory somewhere. Yeah. And then the next morning they'd get up for a doubleheader for Randy. And then they would, you know, Angelo would perform again Sunday night, two more baseball games, you know, and they would that was their kind of weekend. So for Lanny, it was completely and totally like a natural transition. And then, you know, I don't know if he ever gave any thought to doing anything else. I didn't get that indication.
As you were talking, I skimmed through the book real quick and I won't show it because I want people to get your book. But I noticed on the page when you were talking about Lanny as a skinny, tall, blonde kid with a clean shaven, you got a couple of great photos in here. And if you looked at those pictures, I mean, if you saw, that's not a wrestler and that's not Randy Pop or Randy Pop.
Randy Savage in his mid early 20s looked truthfully like Matthew McConaughey, like a young Matthew McConaughey.
He was definitely
handsome. I mean, by all accounts from Lanny, like ladies always loved Randy Savage. But he was not a big bulky dude. He could have been an actor. I mean, in a different world, if he grew up in LA, you could easily see him starring in surfer movies in the 70s.
So as you're talking with Lanny and you're getting some of this background, at what point did Randy Poffo start to really shine as the Macho Man? Where did that Macho Man, who gave him that title? Was that his idea or did that come from the promotion? And how did that character evolve? I do know this. We love his, and I'm not even going to attempt to try it, but his,
So
and the way he did it, you know, with his lips.
Oh, listen, I got my glasses here. I do it all the
time. There you go.
I'm writing. I'm just like, yeah, you got it.
That's it. Hey, you're Macho Man Junior. I like it.
So you have to remember, first he did Randy Savage, right? So there really was, it was in steps.
Yes.
they knew from the promotion standpoint, like I said, they couldn't just show up in every town. And it's like, here's Angelo Poffo and Randy Poffo and Lanny Poffo. It's, how do you have rivalries like that? So they wanted to make sure that they could have two guys fighting over a belt who weren't, you know, brothers. So they tried to come up with something, and you know, Randy wrestled like a savage. There's like all wrestling stories, there's like nine people take credit for who said, you know, who he should be. But ultimately, he settled on Randy Savage because that was how he wrestled. He had the long, wild hair. He did all that. And then it became time to come up with the gimmick, the personality. And so one of the guys that they idolized growing up, who you would know, George, is Pampero Firpo. He wrestled.
That's what I was going to say. Pampero.
They loved him. He had the wild bull milk of Pamplona. He had the crazy hair. He used to do a promo that Lanny said that was when you listened to the radio back when radio was only what you listened to. They would do these promos for the Hawaii circuit for Peter Maivia's, you know, territory and all that. And at the end, it would say, you know, come out to listen to Pampero Firpo. Oh, yeah. And that was his thing. And so when they would talk about, like, who did we love? Who was the most savage looking, like barbaric looking guy? They just kept pointing to him. And so Lanny was like, just what, you know, tap into your version of that. And it's funny because at this point, you know, Randy is still just Randall Poffo, like dork, right? Like it's just, he's not this person. And so he just went into, you know, Lanny says, like, he essentially just holed himself. I mean, he was still working and doing things. He wasn't revealing the character yet, but he holed himself up in any room with any bathroom with a mirror, any room with a mirror, and would just stare in the mirror and try different tones and timbres and guttural stuff. And, you know, he started out, the first one was freak out, freak out. That was like his first catchphrase that he tried back with the ICW. And he would go on these crazy things. The twitching and all that stuff, Lanny said, just, you know, eventually when you're that, you're trying to get the, he just started doing all this stuff. And so that's where it came from. The Macho Man name, you have to, like, there's so many versions of this that he told, that Lanny told. There's a different version in even Judy Papo's obituary. So I'll let you guys read and go through it. And each story is actually awesome. It's like when I go through the stories in the book, like, here's what, you know, this person says, here's what's most likely. I even did the research on why the timeline of why, like, there's no way this one's true. I kind of put them all on trial. It's interesting to note that Randy told two excellent stories that were completely different throughout his career about where the name came from. He changed his tune twice. And one of them makes absolutely no sense, but it's actually the best story. And it's the one I wish were true, but it isn't.
Well, and that's the fun thing about doing wrestler books.
Yeah.
Because, and I get a kick out of it because sometimes, and I've made this comment with no disrespect to any wrestler, but I've made this comment that sometimes the wrestlers themselves aren't the best one to tell their story because they're always bigger, better than they were.
Yeah.
But the reality is, yes, they do know themselves really well. And Randy did.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest differences of writing this kind of book than Mean Joe Green, the Charlie Ward biography. You know, if I'm talking to Charlie Ward about a rivalry game against Florida State in 1992, I, you know, he says, I threw for three touchdowns. It was amazing. We had this fourth quarter comeback. And I go, you know, these guys have photographic memory, so this wouldn't happen with Charlie. And I go back and look and realize, actually, you lost that game, or you only threw one touchdown, and it was a rushing touchdown in the fourth. It's very easy to go back. With these guys, I mean, I have no idea. You know, you just kind of they tell a story, and it's just their storytelling. From what I've learned, is just like when they were in the ring. If something's drawing heat, if something's getting a pop, they embellish that part. And so, you know, by a 10-year-old version of a story, the actual story, it's like I went to the store, and then the rest of the story is I went to the store, and a clown fought me, and a bazooka came out, and all these things that didn't happen become the story of when you went to that store. You know. And that's one their of the job.
Yeah, and one of the greatest things about the older wrestlers, when you tell that, is we tease because you can get the wrestlers together and they start telling their stories to each other and around a crowd. And every place they wrestled, they sold out the house.
Everyone.
They blew the roof off. Yeah. And we know that's not true.
Yeah.
Not every place was a sellout. But one of my favorites was I was in a locker room about 10 years ago, and there were two old wrestlers. They had their T-shirts on, and the T-shirts read, and it was great. The older we get, the better we were.
Yes, that's accurate, you know? For all wrestlers,
And that was really the way it was. So Lanny Poffo, you get this story about the Macho Man. Do you want to advance a little bit and get to the WWF how
that whatever you guys want to talk about. I'm down for whatever.
Let's go with it. So how does he get to the WWF? Because when that promotion started the raids of the territories in 1984, 85.
Yeah.
Vince McMahon Jr. was going national. He started taking wrestlers from all the main territories, the big stars. Well, you know, we had the Hulk Hogan, of course, the biggest one. We had Million Dollar Man. We had the Freebirds. We had, you know, the Jesse Venturas and all these people, the Von Erichs, they're all coming in. And then there's this guy named Macho. Tell how that came about.
Yeah, Macho owes the liaison between Vince and or the McMahons at the time and Macho was Jimmy Hart, who incredibly enough for a bulk of the time in the ICW when they were rivals with Jerry Lawler, hated each other. They didn't trust each other. They hated each other. The Macho Man and Lanny did everything in their power to undermine and try to put Lawler out of business, which was never going to happen because Lawler was like McDonald's and Ace ICW was like the hamburger stand on the side of the road, basically, when they started. Yeah. Right. And they tried, they did their best. But ultimately, they got booted from Rupp Arena, which was the cash cow back then. If you were in Kentucky and you couldn't perform at Rupp, like what exactly? It's like being in Vegas and not being able to perform at casinos. Like, what are you going to do? Where is your money going to come from? And so when they eventually, they reconciled business-wise because they realized they built up this rivalry and Macho and they could make a lot of money with Macho and Lawler actually fighting each other. And then Jimmy Hart gets the call up to called up to New York, which is essentially you're up to the big leagues, so WWF. And the word was, Vince had seen some tapes scouting other people and scouting territories, and he had asked Jimmy Hart to go down and see what Macho thought. The funny part is Macho was so paranoid as always, but at this point in particular, that he didn't believe him. He thought Jimmy was like, had wired devices on him and was trying to set him up for a work. And so ultimately he finally believed that, Jimmy Hart was telling the truth, and they were able to get him up there.
So he comes up to the WWF, and I do remember this as a fun time watching that. I know he got involved with George the Animal Steele, who I had seen evolve. You talk about character transformations.
Yes,
I saw George Steele when he was wrestling part time back in the 60s. And he was a school teacher.
Yeah.
And he would wrestle without the schools knowing it, wearing a mask.
Nice.
And he'd go on a cart.
Yep.
And he was the student under a mask. But, and that George Steele, I would point out, was the original George Steele, was a mean, bully, scratching, clawing, growling type guy.
Mm.
But by the time he got to the Randy Savage part, it seems like George Steele had digressed a little bit, and he couldn't talk English.
Yeah, he was a simpleton.
He had that green tongue, and so that was a natural. I think that was a great how they led into that feud, which will probably take us into Elizabeth.
Yeah, that was. I mean, that she was the feud. I mean, without that, it was a weird. It was just weird. I mean, thinking about it now, almost like, so all this happened. I was like 8, 9 years old, so I believed. Like everything. I believe that Macho would harm Elizabeth if not for the valiant but stupid, Neanderthal George Animal Steele protecting her.
Kind of a childlike character.
Yeah, like I think I call him like a Neanderthal Forrest Gump in the book. Like that was basically a character. And so looking back now that was an angle, it's almost hilarious that they went with that and it worked. But as a kid, I was like, George, like don't put yourself between these two. He's going to hurt you. You don't know how mean he is. And I was just as a Macho fan. And so, that was one of those weird things that I don't know if they ever thought it was going to have the legs that it did. And I was going to run all the way to having him in Steamboat's Corner, WrestleMania and all that stuff. But it worked. It was just something primal about like the tough guy, the damsel in distress, the almost like a of Mice and Men, type character, trying to do what's right. And it just was very tapped into something very human between Macho, that triangle, even though it's like, realistically when he's carrying Elizabeth off, like, especially as an adult, that's why I always laugh. Like what the hell were like normal 35 year olds thinking? Like, what is this? What is going on here? You know?
Well, it was sort of like a Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. Story. Yeah.
You know, that did Elizabeth, you know, the storyline was, did she have feelings for this poor sympathetic, childlike character? Brian, do you remember George?
Who was 30 years older than her, by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah. I do remember it. And I was, you know, I was a teenager by then, and, you know, actually, I kind of believed it too. I'll be honest with you. And
right.
I was like, you know, it was really weird. It was very strange. Good storyline. I mean, it worked. So
well, and I will tell you this: you go back, you know, a few years when I said George Steele was a legitimate bully.
Yeah.
He didn't have this childlike gimmick, and he had matches with Bruno Sammartino, and he was a legitimate challenger, and. The cool part about it was, is that because wrestling was as it was, John, in those days, the fans were cyclical, the promoters, that if you didn't, you know, a couple of years down the road, you don't remember what happened. And so this wasn't the same George Steele, and it was a whole different character. So the Elizabeth thing then we saw, man, I remember the one scene where Hogan and Savage were getting involved with Elizabeth and fighting each other, or the jealousy. And it was a great storyline. It had me, and I long ago, for, you know, realized that it wasn't real. I loved it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of those things where, like, the best, most believable storylines in wrestling always have just that kernel of truth, or at least the nugget of believability, you know, you'd say. Mm-hmm. And that one, by all accounts, was not a real thing until it became, like, that was where, like, art imitated life imitated art. Like, nobody thought that, and nobody thought there was any jealousy, and there wasn't any sort of sober minded person who thought Hogan was trying to steal Elizabeth. He was, you know, in that whole sequence. However, all you had to do was plant the seed, especially in someone like Macho. And then maybe he's spending so much time pretending that he was, that he thought he really was. And from a storyline and fan perspective, I mean, being 8 years old and having the Mega Powers handshake happen, it's still like a top five entertainment moment in my life. Yeah. Like, you're watching this and your head explodes. Like, you're the two biggest names in wrestling who you don't know, you know, many of this is planned at the time if you're a kid. They're shaking hands and they're going to join forces. And Elizabeth goes and gets Hogan. I mean, when that even happens, you're like, wait, what is going on here? Like, she's running down the aisle and she's bringing back the Hulkster to help out. Like, it's so hard for people to get. And that's what I try to do in the book, is to take people, like, forget you're reading this as a 35 or 45 or 65 year old. Read this as when it was in its prime, for that peak 8 to 12. And then also, I would say, I think teenagers were at that point was a little more innocent. It was easier to suspend your disbelief on some of these things, go with it. And they spent, you know, almost a year and a half on that storyline, just playing it, tweaking it. Then when you look back, you know, they got Macho acting his butt off, basically, like, really setting up the stage for the jealousy and all the things that would happen. And then when they, you know, then the Mega Powers implode, you were like torn. There was Team Macho and Team Hulk, and how could he do this? And you'd flip flop one, you know. There was no Twitter or dirt sheets or anything to follow between the matches. So you'd leave a Saturday night main event or a Sunday morning match or wherever, you know, some of these aired even on local TV 2 days after they were supposed to, who knows
what. Right. Yeah.
With nothing to go off of. And you'd maybe miss the next one because you never knew when the hell these things were on. And then all of a sudden you'd be like, wait a minute, she's in his corner now, and what is happening here? And it was really, really fascinating.
Yeah. And I remember that storyline when you talk about the Mega Powers breaking up. And I really enjoyed this storyline at the time. And I do recall, and I think it's out there probably on YouTube or something, the hospital, not the hospital scene, but the emergency room scene where Elizabeth is carried in there and Randy and Hulk are kind of getting into a shoving
match.
Yeah, that's
backstage. Yeah, that was in
the backstage deal. And, you know, she's begging them, please don't. And they end up shoving one another, and then Randy's pounding on the Hulkster. And when you talk about that suspension of disbelief, you know, that was the fun part about wrestling still in those days, because even though you knew they were staging it, this was enough to draw me in, just like a good movie where, you know, it's not real and your heart is pumped. And that was a good scene.
That's great.
I wanted to ask you, can I go? Yeah.
No, go.
I wanted to move forward just a little bit, if I could, and we can circle back if George wants to. But when he left the WWF, you know, he went into that commentary role for a while. You know, things were kind of on the outs or whatever. And then he ended up in, you know, WCW a little bit later on. Was there some real tension between him and McMahon? Because they had those little skits on for a while, yeah. You remember, and him and Hogan, and they were basically Nacho mocking Man. How old they are, and, you know, oh, yeah, you know, and coming out with a cane or something like that, or a walker. Yeah. Was there some real tension there, or was that – did this Randy get – I don't think he blew it off, but I mean
– no, the line that Lanny told me was, you know, Randy had an FU list a mile long and added to it daily, and Vince was at the top, right? Like, so, you know, towards the end of his career, it seemed like things – you know, the end of his life, I mean, it seemed like things were thawing. He was getting involved with the WWE action figures. He let him film at his house. There's a lot of interviews, people I talked to who, like, if we had just had another 3 or 4 years of him, I think he would have had a grand return and a second act and bringing him back in the fold, it seems. But at the time, no, Randy was beyond pissed. He took the commentary thing because, you know, between, you know, you have to remember, not only did they have the mega powers implode, not only did he lose the belt to Ultimate Warrior, not only did they then have the wedding and the wedding at SummerSlam, he actually was getting divorced like the week before the actual fake wedding. I mean, it was a lot to process.
Gosh, okay.
That's what I was going to allude to that.
Yeah, his real life was in shambles while he was supposedly marrying, while he's marrying Elizabeth in front of the world, making our moment happen. Behind the scenes, they were barely talking anymore. Their marriage was fractured. And in fact, I think it was the next issue or the issue after that of WWF Magazine where he writes the letter to everybody saying it's true. We're divorced. He takes off a little time and then comes back, and he's a pretty good commentator. I mean, he's still got all the charisma. He's doing a good job.
Yeah.
But he was itching to get back in the ring. McMahon wanted to go with that next stable of guys. And Randy had, you know, he was meticulous in everything he did, and he had a plan. He really wanted to finish his career on. He had a dream match sketched out with Shawn Michaels. He believed that Shawn could give him like the closing bookend to his match with Ricky Steamboat, like someone who was physically his equal, as athletic, obviously younger at that time, but could really build. He wanted to build like a year and a half storyline and then retire on a loss, basically, to Shawn Michaels. And Vince was just like, no, we're moving. Hulk's not here. You're not here. I want all these young guys. And, you know, Vince on camera said, you know, we love you, blah, blah, blah. But Randy never forgot that he wasn't allowed to leave on his terms with all he did for that company.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. I thought so, but, you know, storylines, they were more believable back then that, you know, we didn't have, like you said, the internet, Twitter, Facebook, all this stuff. And so what you saw on TV, you know, the kayfabe was, you know, what you thought. And yeah, I just think it's very interesting because he never went back there from what I understand. Yeah. And usually when somebody leaves on those kind of terms, like there's some other wrestlers that we've spoken with in the past, George and I, that don't have a lot of great thoughts about old Vince at the end of their career.
He is very polarizing for sure.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it. Very polarizing. As you've done the book and now you're waiting for the release, tell us when it's going to be coming out.
Yes. The book comes out April 2nd, WrestleMania week. It is
great timing.
I like it.
Yeah, that well, we pegged that. You know, that's one of those where 2 years ago it was like it's going to come out WrestleMania 40. Like it has to come out WrestleMania 40. So, you know, that was one of those where it says a hard deadline, you know, 9 months ago to finish everything so we can get the book up and running and out in time. And so, it comes out WrestleMania week. You know, pre-orders for books, anyone who's in the publishing, are huge. They really, really matter. So whenever, if you're airing this beforehand, go out and buy the book now. Don't wait. It'll show up on your doorstep beautifully on April 2nd. So that's always cool.
Give the website. Give how they can
so
pre-order.
I have my website is johnfinkel.com, JonFinkel.com, or if you're on Twitter or X at John_Finkel. I have a newsletter, Books and Biceps, where you can sign up easily on the site where I have all of the giveaways. I have a bunch of like cool macho swag. I have I have awesome, like their silver hologram stickers of the book there cover, which looks great. I have a sign.
I don't have one.
There you go.
You got to have your buddy hook you up there. I have signed book plates to give anyone who gets it. So if you do order the book and you have a minute, send me a signed screenshot of the order and your address. You can DM me a bunch of different ways, either through my website on social. Okay. And I will send you the signed stuff. So, yeah,
I'm going to get you to sign mine. I want to get you to sign mine somehow. So we'll
have to send me your address. That's what I have the book plates for. So I sign them. They're like stickers that go inside the book.
Yeah.
And they have a cool Macho Man logo and stuff on them. So I will definitely, I'll glad to do that if you want to send me your address after the show.
John, I want to thank you for coming on. I'm going to buy the book. I'll pre-order it. And I will have everything in the description of how you can get this book and all his websites. And if you will like his other books, which I'm sure you will, he's done a lot. And I'll be honest, I didn't really know you that well before the Macho Man book, but after going through your website and doing a little research on you, you've done a lot of good writing. And one last question before we go, What got you involved in writing? Because you write about all these athletes and some fitness things. I mean, what drove you to be a writer? I mean, you've done all these old magazines too and stuff.
Yeah. The easiest answer for that is I was always a reader first. I was the kid at the library devouring, you know, the latest, you know, Matt Christopher book, or I read, you know, Sports Illustrated cover to cover. I was like a 9-year-old going through like the Boston Globe sports section, reading Bob Ryan. Like that was my thing. I love sports. I played sports my whole entire life. Obviously I would have, you know, being an athlete would have been everybody's number one thing. But I love writing. I always loved writing. I always wanted to write. And so basically right out of school, I went to school, you know, to write, but you know, again, like there's no real path to take there. You could try, but newspapers were dying right when I got out of school. So that was done. Yeah. Magazines started dying like very soon after. So it was just, I think almost every writer, I've yet to meet a really great writer or someone who wanted to be a writer who didn't start off as a voracious reader. And then that's where I started.
Okay.
The one thing that I want to say to everyone that will see this and when it airs, and as Brian said, he's going to put all the information on there, how to order the copy, how to get an autograph, et cetera. I really, as I'm looking through it, we haven't even touched the surface on how good, as I've looked at the chapters, and the main event is in this book, folks. You really need to get Macho Man, The Untamed, Unbelievable Life of Randy Savage. And John, I thank you. I appreciate you doing this. It's a job well done.
Thank you very much. It means a lot.
Thank you. And we'll be in touch so I can get this autograph and you can prove to me that you know how to write. That's what I always
tell. My brother always says, I'm just a typer. I'm not even a writer anymore.
Yeah, that's what I always tell people. They want an autograph. I say, well, you can know I can write, but here it is.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much. And really, I hope you sell 1 million copies.
Me too.
I think you will. I'm going to order one right after this. But folks, if you're watching, thank you. Again, John Finkel, author. The book is called Macho Man, The Untamed, Unbelievable Life Story of Randy Savage. Go to Amazon. Go to his website.
You got to do it right.
Folks, if you're watching, thank you. If you're listening, thank you. Go to that website. I'll have it in the description. If you haven't subscribed, please do so, and we will talk to you soon.
Hey, this is a Total Package. Lex Luger. You're listening to the VOC Nation. Don't miss out.
VOC Nation's own Stro Maestro suffered a major medical and financial catastrophe this year. From the VOC Nation family, to all of you, please continue to pray for Stro Maestro for his continued recovery. You can also donate to his cause, paypal.me/PapaStro. The worldwide leader in entertainment. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Check out In the Room
every Tuesday night at 9. Listen in.
Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Brady Hicks, former WCW star Stro Maestro, Kazzy Fist, Matt Grimm.
And you and Ray are there too, right, Ray?
We sure are, and we've got great guests like Lex Luger, AJ Styles, Taku, and more. It's a heck of a party. Plus, I didn't get thrown off buildings.
And then
didn't
get pregnant.
I didn't get pregnant either.
Sometimes I think it gets so ridiculous.
We were getting into, like, snuff film territory there.
In the room.
9 p.m. Eastern on VOC Nation.
Yo, this is Jerry Stein of the Nasty Boys. Yeah, Brian Knobs here. You getting ready to get nasty? Well, listen to the VOC Nation, baby.
VOC Nation is one of the longest-running wrestling podcast networks. Having started way back in 2010, VOC Nation provides daily streaming shows where fans have the ability to interact with their hosts and guests via phone calls, emails, and Twitter. VOC Nation hosts include former backstage interviewer from both AWA and WWE, Ken Resnick, former WCW performer The Maestro, former Impact performer Wes Crisco, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributor Brady Hicks, and former Philadelphia radio personality Bruce Works. Archive free content includes past interviews with huge names like Hulk Hogan, Jesse Ventura, Kurt Angle, Jimmy Hart, Ricky Steamboat, Sting, Mick Foley, Joey Styles, Howard Finkel, and so many more. Listen live at VOCNation.com and subscribe to all the podcasts by searching VOC Nation Radio Network on your favorite podcast app. And be sure to follow these guys on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Phil Apter has been in the pro wrestling business for over 50 years.
Hey, Tony here with Arn Anderson. Arn, first of all, your height and weight.
6'1", 255.
And now subscribers to VOC Nation Premium get exclusive access to Bill Apter's archived audio footage.
And where's your hometown?
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay, and give us something about your back. First of all, your relationship to Ole Anderson.
Ole is my...
Subscription to VOC Nation Premium starts at just $3 a month and includes commercial-free audio and video versions of our top podcasts.
Okay, we're speaking here with the manager of the World Heavyweight Tag Team Champions, Tarzan Tyler and Luke Graham, and he's sort of glowing tonight about a new prospect we haven't heard of yet.
And for just $9 a month, Apter's archives are all yours.
Would you tell us who this new prospect
is? Well, I'll tell you, Bill, I've searched the world, and I finally found a true world champion. I finally found...
What's your opinion of Ivan Koloff winning the title from Bruno Sammartino?
Well, I think, I don't know what to say, but I want to say one thing. Bruno was a hell of a champion. You know?
Hear exclusive interviews with the greatest performers of all time.
This is Bill Apter, and once again, we're speaking here with Bruno Sammartino. Bruno, first of all, how did you and Bruiser lose that title to the Valiants?
Well, actually, it was a very unusual loss, if you want to call it a loss.
Didn't have anything to do?
Well, yes, but the whole thing is this, that the rules, as I always understood them, was that the title could only be lost by pin or submission, which is the same rules as my title, the World Wrestling Federation. That night, it was...
To sign up, it's very simple. Head to premium.vocnation.com or go to patreon.com/vocnation. VOC Nation takes you behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history.
Each and every Thursday night, check it out. WCW star Stro Maestro takes you on a journey. It's WCW Retro. Talking old school match of the week, talking dream matches, taking your calls and looking back on an incredible career of acting, entertaining, and wrestling. Check it out, VOCNation.com, WCW Retro. Be sure to call in Thursday nights, 9 Eastern, on the VOC Nation Radio Network.
This is Matt Hardy, and you are listening to the VOC Nation.